This is a production of Cornell University.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to our, what are we in, the fourth meeting? Third meeting? I don't know. One of the meetings. It's March 4th. I'm a little late for 5:30. We're going to go ahead and get started close to on time today, since President Scorton and Vice President Murphy are going to join us here in a little bit. Sorry I don't have any cool facts for you guys today, like I did last time. Maybe I'll come up with something next time. So first we'll do introduction to the voting members, like always. Mia, are you here?
Yes.
Great, thanks. Trevaney?
Yes.
Fantastic. Phil?
Yes.
Great. Eric?
Yes.
Giovanna?
Yes.
Great. Jonathan is not here. Knew that. Liz?
Here.
Thanks. I'm here. Nicole's here. Alex? Yes. Great. Jenny? Jenny here yet? Okay. Matt?
Yeah.
Great, thanks. Rob?
Yeah.
Awesome, thanks. Eric? No Eric. David? Awesome. Christine? Awesome, great, thanks. Han? Saw you, great. Drew is not here, he's sick, and Monet. Fantastic, thanks.
Jenny just walked in.
Okay. So we're going to go ahead and skip to the approval of the minutes from February 18th. The minutes were sent out on Friday, or Saturday, I think it was, actually. Sorry about that. I contributed to that delay. Did anyone have any changes or amendments to the minutes that were sent out? Great. Fantastic. Great. Seeing no changes, the minutes are approved. We'll go ahead and move into the introduction of Resolution 13. Rob, if you want to start us off, and if President Scorton and Vice President Murphy come in, you'll obviously see them, and I'll cut us off halfway through and we'll come back to it. So, take it away.
Sure. So, in the meeting on Saturday, you guys have read Resolution 13. This resolution is really about working in divestment from fossil fuels, which the undergraduate student assembly recently passed resolution into the Climate Action Plan, which is university's goal of being carbon neutral by 2050. So this is just an overview of the endowment. Cornell is an endowment of over $5 billion, which is one of the largest of any university. And I just wanted to show you that it's made up 55% of equity, so that's like tradable assets, securities, bonds, things like that. And then a large portion of it is real estate and other things. And so there's different pools and funds, and it's a little complicated, but it's important to know that it's all pretty much invested equally by the Board of Trustees, Investment Committee, and the Investment Office. Nice. So this is the chart of crude oil prices since 1861. The dark green line is in the dollars of the day. The light green line is adjusted to be in today's dollars. And this chart is primarily to show you that traditionally fossil fuels have been actually a really good investment if you're looking at them from a financial standpoint. So I put the slide in here to kind of show you the difficulty of the decision on this issue. But here's a couple more charts. This is atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gases. These two charts, so that we have carbon dioxide, methane, common greenhouse gases. They start right around the time of multi-cell life starts. That's the timeline on the left. And then right before that giant upswing, that's right around when humans become existent. So this is just kind of showing that we have got ourselves into a little spot of trouble. Right. And so here we're just zooming in on these two charts. This is methane, and then mixed because the next slide. This is carbon dioxide. And so if you notice, this chart on the right starts around 1950, and that's parts per million carbon dioxide. But the important thing to take away from this is that it's actually an exponential curve. So greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are increasing exponentially. And then next, we're going to go to the next one. Right. So here's, well, many of us are at Cornell, here's some data on carbon dioxide emissions while we're here, showing that even in the short time span we're here, they're going up pretty rapidly.
Yeah, we'll let our guests, if you guys want to come down to the front, we'll let you get settled. And Robbie, you can, is that all right? You want to finish one or two slides while they get set? They've probably heard this a million times, so.
All right, so going back when I said concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere increasing exponentially, this chart is to show you that emissions, or the amount we put into the atmosphere, are increasing linearly. So we keep increasing the amount we put in, the amount within the atmosphere increases exponentially. And so here's a breakdown of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide. We have a lot more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than other gases. The carbon dioxide is kind of hard to measure how long it sticks around in the atmosphere. And the very can see very quickly as the ocean surface kind of blasted back up, or it can come in for years. It's really hard to measure. Methane, the average methane molecule stays in the atmosphere for about 12 years. A nitrous oxide molecule typically stays in the atmosphere for about 100 years. And so that's where we get the relationship between linearly increasing emissions and exponentially increasing amount greenhouse gases like carbon per million.
Austin, I'm going to cut you off there, and we'll pick it up after our guest. So, moving back. Thank you, President Thornton and Vice President Murphy, for joining us once again. Yeah. So we'll go ahead and give you both the floor to start, and then we'll take questions like we did last time.
I was just going to say that I'm looking forward to having a chance to read through the GCI documents that have been shared on the draft. I was proud of what you guys have been working on. And I suspect it will be the case. There will be some stuff that will be for a total agreement and some stuff that I'm going, are you guys kidding? But I really, and my purpose of reading it is only to just give any feedback. It's not for me to approve or to not, which is really your document. So I want to thank you for that for you to go and read it in advance. I have done it. And Mitch, look forward to what you'll present to the trustees as part of your report this month. Mm-hmm. And then we'll see where we might go from there. And the second thing I would say is thanks for the opportunity to join you at the Diamond Festival. I enjoyed that very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kudos to David Bunk and Yevgeny and the Mayor Student Advocacy Committee.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about that later on. But,
yeah. So in the email that Mitchell sent an email ahead of time with some questions that he anticipates coming up, and also at the end of the email he said that the GPSA has sort of mind you on graduate education. I'd like to invite myself back to Dr. Murphy, and I didn't answer this already, so I'm going to say no. At a separate time to talk more in depth about that larger issue. But I just want to say a couple things real quick about
sure.
it because of the timeliness of a political thing that happened. So Friday, President Obama signed into law the executive order to sequester. And I have been one of the people who fears that this would happen, unfortunately. And I'm been pretty fervent that we're going to, I believe, at the end of the day, sustain ongoing cuts in a lot of these programs. And so I think there's two big aspects of graduate education. Many more things that we should talk about, but two big aspects that I just want to mention today. And if you choose to talk about those things, I'd love to talk about them, or not, or take other questions. Some of the members that we should post. One is the effect on graduate students and disciplines that depend on external research funding, which Cornell is extraordinarily focused on by the nature of the state funding and individual funding, which they come into. And what is likely or possible the effect will be, not just on the current research project, but on people's career plans and the prospects, you know, for a career based in science. And we then talk a little bit about some conjectures that I have about it. And the second issue is the converse or the complement, and that is grad students and disciplines that do not currently have external funding to speak of, some humanistic disciplines, social sciences, there's funding from the SDE Director of the National Science Foundation and some other foundations. But I think there will be also effects that are less publicized in those direct and indirect areas. So I think it's a really important time for schools that do compete very successfully for funding, like we talked about, you know, what people might hold. And I don't have any real hard and fast answers, obviously, because we're just beginning this process, but I'm thinking a lot about it and listening to people around the country, visiting members of Congress. So those are the two things that I'm most focused on right now. Another time measure is comfortable. So maybe we can come back for 20 minutes or something and just focus completely on, you know, looking out there and obvious things that you all have talked about in various venues with me and separately about academic careers, non-academic careers, placement, preparation, and also one other issue I hope we can talk about at that subsequent meeting, and that is mid-career changes. Mm-hmm. Because in a lot of other areas, talk about mid-career changes, and in funding economic times, I think it's important also to think about people who finished at Cornell 10 or 15 years ago and, you know, end up with some dislocation because of economic conditions. And what sort of things would you be thinking about in terms of making your own backgrounds and other grad students as flexible and versatile as possible, especially since the graduate education region is particularly around the focus of something, sort of have to exclude other things to focus and drill down. So just some general remarks and where do you want to talk about the rest of the day?
Sure, and we do have everyone's, I think on April 8th, Provost Fox is coming to join us. So I'll email your office and maybe
okay.
We can see if that works.
Okay.
Have you guys back. But as we had mentioned in the email and as I had sent to the president, and I may have forgot to actually send it to Susan Murphy, and sorry about that if I did. We had thought about four different topics as a part of the future of graduate education. The future of humanities, which I know has been a hot topic among some of our humanities students. The influence of in changing landscape of non-academic careers out of graduate school. Federal and state budget concerns, which the president has mentioned, and then the graying of faculty is a topic that's come up. So why don't we open up for questions? Does anyone have any questions? Start with Evan. Start us off. I didn't see any other hands flying up. Yeah.
So you probably are aware, I'm sure, that the White House has recently issued a memorandum to its various agencies that, like the NSF already does, they will require any agency with over, if there are any agencies left after sequester, that have over $100 million annually in budgets, that they require the researchers that they're funding to make their material available after an embargo period. Available to public free of charge, except for the way that the NSF already does. My question is, as this open access movement seems to gather momentum, which I think is wonderful and commendable, how can we at Cornell encourage, I think especially in my opinion, senior faculty to continue to support the open access efforts that are going on out there? Because I'm troubled, I guess, that research that is often funded by taxpayer dollars or private granting foundations or what have you ends up locked up in for-profit journals. And the for-profit of the journal is not going to the people who did the research, it's not going to the editors who are volunteer faculty typically, it's not going to the editorial boards who are again volunteer faculty. To ask the question more bluntly, how can we encourage our faculty especially, and maybe provide incentives for more junior faculty and for graduate students, to stop supporting a for-profit publication enterprise that locks up scientific research?
This is a big topic. I'll try to be as brief as I can. You know, generally I can't be brief if I understand, but otherwise Dr. Murphy's question. And she might tend to Dr. Hubble's answer using that very briefly if I help us out. This is a huge topic, and I think the question is the right question. I think the orientation of the faculty, as we know through wellness, that I'm going to use one orientation. I'll tell you why I think that. So this is one of those few areas where I've been involved in this for a very long time, since long before I was a partner with the Association of Research Libraries and moved it some years ago. Because it's just what you're implying to be the right verb, and that is, it's just be blunt about it, keep me blunt or more blunt. Could you boycott? I'm not going to mention publishers, because there's more than one. That does the following phenomenon. That does the following phenomenon. Take the work supported by your taxpayer dollars or from the institution or from the third parties, charging page charges, pitch you to review in peer review fashion the article to get an incentive, pitch you to serve as an editorial consultant on the journal, graphic, or for a cup of coffee, cheap. Then charge you for the subscription to the journal. And charge your library. So we actually tried to start a national movement some years ago here's what happened. I was talked out of it the last minute by senior graduate students at the institution. Why? Because they said what you're going to do in this boycott is correct the problem on the backs of a new generation of people who will not get published in the journals that are considered marks of success. Put their, if you're in tenure track, put the possibility of being in tenure at risk for promotion. And the people who have already got tenure or already established in the field can boycott it. But what are the junior faculty doing? So please don't do that. Find another way to do it. And I respond to that because these are people that have greatest risk. A couple of things have changed since then. One is generated from this institution as archive, as an example. Now, it's in one discipline, although it's become broader in this discipline. That's a terrific example of open access in a funny way, right? So it's post-publication peer review, things like that. And so there are experiments like that going on. Secondly, these kind of open access mandates at various agencies or something in that direction, the NIH will open this up. But still, I don't think it's the faculty themselves that can take this on, because it'll still, in 2013, despite archive and despite the opening of open access, still be a challenge for people trying to establish their success in the field, you see what I'm saying, by saying, well, if you're boycotting the paper, don't send my paper to the journal. Or if you're in this return, you're a publication of the book, this is a mark of progress. Don't go with it if you're a publisher. So that's not to say we should give up, but I think that it's an ongoing problem. I think it's not right to balance it on the back of junior faculty. And I think that it may be worthwhile, you want to think about these notions and talk to the other assembly members. You may want to get on in tenure or fabulous, a librarian. We saw a lot about this. From the point of view of both the actual cost of doing business, as well as being really up to date with the Association of Research Libraries, which formerly owned the most style for most of the research institutions, and make sure that you guys are starting a conversation, some sort of a modern version of that. I think you'll find that this issue of junior faculty having their individual careers sort of raised by 45 is still the case. And I belong to some professional societies that used to publish their own journals, and they have now been taken over by the post-doctoral publishers. And so, in some ways, I'm sorry to report there's some opposite there. But I do think that there is a chance for more action on this because of the advent of more open access standards, at least in the fields in which you're getting from the agency and the system. And at Cornell, you know, we're sort of in a situation that's very, very common. We're always in the top 4 or 5 schools in the country, sometimes it's the top 1 or 2. But once again, for all the people who get money from other sources, they don't have that little bit of advantage of the money. So it's a terrific thing. I hope you'll think about having it. If you don't want to have it or the time doesn't allow it, if you wouldn't be so good, send me the real brief emails, I don't forget, and I'll talk to you. Maybe she could send something that could just be shared right in GPSA if the schedule doesn't work out or if she can't make it. It would be of interest for you. I know she had lots to say about it.
She's actually ahead of you. She asked to join us already. So, yeah.
Thank you.
So
thanks, Doug. That's a really important question.
Yeah, Adrian?
Okay, Alex? I had a question about how you're going to use the GPI update. I was wondering if you could provide an example from the original GPI where you can publish it in your decision.
So, in the original GPI, we probably did the most for some of the areas that were not really big recommendations, but some really big recommendations for examples around a new graduate center and things like that. But there was quite a bit of conversation there around career services, mental health, the involvement of graduate students around some of those issues, and we used them quite helpfully. And ultimately, in the area of the career services, partly with graduate school information, did a good bit of work when we went through the budget reduction. We had a career task force. Rebecca Farrell worked a lot with the various career folks in specific professional masters to see what work were they doing that really needed to be only in that field and what work were they doing that really could be shared more broadly. For example, the resume workshop. There are particular avenues that you might take whether you're finding real estate or you're going on in the business world or others, but some of that can be shared more broadly. So it was some of the impetus we had on the CI of the interest among the graduate school students and the professional school students to see more attention in the area that gave us the books from that. So that's a very specific example. I think in general what happened in the last GCI is it created a focus of conversation about some of the broader issues. It didn't necessarily lead to, as I said, a new graduate center or our expanded graduate housing in a significant way. But I think it did sensitize a lot of us, and particularly in the Division of Student and Academic Services, that is charged to serve all students, but isn't always perceived, particularly by the part of graduate professional students, that the work that we do is for all students. And so we try to sensitize us to our language, our efforts being more intentional in reaching out to the graduate community to include them, as well as then prompts for conversation with Dean Hubble, then Dean Power, now especially Dean New. So there are some examples where we have quite formally linked roles that were not otherwise linked as a way of trying to create a connection for the graduate community with the university services that come out as an example of the students as well. I haven't yet read this version, so I'm not exactly sure where the area of emphasis. I said to Mitch, I haven't gotten it last night, but he has gotten my notes done before I come to the meeting, so hopefully I will not get it done because it's the same. But I'm going to suggest, my guess is it'll be in some of the same areas. So I'm going to anticipate there will be things that we all would agree would be wonderful to have. I'll pick one that was made come out of Rebecca's committee, free access to the health, to the fitness centers for graduate students, a particular one. That's going to be very hard for us to respond to. We're trying to understand, are we offering programs and opportunities and schedules that are conducive to the graduate community to use that resource, or are we only building our schedule around what the undergraduates are doing? Those are the kinds of things that may come up. I'm sure there will be continued conversation about how do we help the graduate student community, and I mean it because of graduate students more than the professional students. And I'm including that professional masters. I'm not going to say the gentleman or the law or the vet when I make this. To build a sense of community. The reason I'm excluding those is I think they do in their smaller schools have a sense of community, the Johnson and Law. But it could be a challenge across the 5,000 graduate students to build that sense of community. We're not going to solve it by expanding our housing dramatically, but we need to be quite intentional about what are some things that we can do. So I think it will certainly prompt conversation, it will inform some of our ongoing planning, and I expect it will create a feedback mechanism that we will want to continue.
I didn't get that right.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
No,
I can. We'll finalize it and vote on it as a whole document at our next meeting on March 25th.
What do you think the role of this graduation should be in a post-sequestration environment? How can we, have the most impact on supporting higher education when cuts are happening?
Yeah, so first of all, through Mitch and others, you guys have already done a really terrific job, and I wouldn't say that just as a throwaway. I'm taking your story to condos. And it is much more effective when the students come than it is when I go or the lobbyists go. Not because they don't receive us, they do, but you're not only constituents, but you're the future of the country, so it's very, very effective. Despite that, the combination of the real revenue problems that the country has, and the debt, and the political landscape, to use a euphemism instead of saying knuckleheads, it makes it an unsettled time. So I have thought that one you might ask me that, and so I'll give you my three answers. It's not a big institutional national thing. This is just what I think. One is you should continue, either as individuals or through organized advocacy or calling, to make your case heard. In particular, examples of how hard it is to get funding already, and what it will mean. The NSF had talked about, I'm sure you saw this already, eliminating 1,000 new grants out of our way, many thousands of grants, but still just choosing a round number like that. Vice President Johnson and others are part of advocacy organizations within higher ed organizations that are calculating the potential impact. So anyway, making it a real live example as opposed to some general concept like we always need more research funding by constituent, I think it's really important. And you did a good job, preemptively doing that before mission. But this is a big focal point. Secondly, I think it's really important, and please take this as genuine, not to lose confidence in the future. The people lined up on our side in this, besides higher education, are powerful forces in favor of continuing very robust research funding. It's the industrial community and high-tech disciplines, big manufacturing companies, aerospace. I'll tell you a quick thing that some of you know about this, but you should take heart from this. In the mid-90s, when the country was working under a so-called Balanced Budget Act, I can work in it, remember, very difficult time. It was the industrial community that came forward. Norm Weinstein, who at that time was the CEO of Lockheed Martin, got a bunch of other CEOs of high-tech manufacturing companies and other big companies. We're an op-ed for one of the big national papers that taped an hour with the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, or the New York Times, and it got turned down. So they decided that's okay. They just bought a full-page ad. And then later, what they wrote up on this full-page ad got some award for the eloquence of the advocacy. And they were a potent part of the force to return some momentum to research funding. And we're working hard, a lot of us who interact with folks on the other side of the graduate experience. A lot of you will end up working in industry, and even if you don't end up working in industry, a lot of you will do research that's relevant to the industry. And even if you don't end up doing that, a lot of you will do research that's read by people who do things relevant to industry. So we have a lot of supporters. So I urge you not to lose heart, not to lose the confidence that coming from a really top department with a top school, you will prevail with a very good career option. But the uncertainty is harder to deal with. That even if you knew exactly what the effect was going to be, you develop a strategy to deal with it, some tactics. But not knowing what it is going to be tough. And the third thing is related to that, and that is to keep yourself informed. And maybe it's not for me to tell you, but if there's an appropriate committee, the GPSA or something, make us work for you on that. Contact Vice President Johnson, and we're going to try to keep track of ways by agency or by discipline, depending on which makes more sense, to try to get information on what the likely outcomes are going to be. The period between now and March 27, when there has to be a vote related to continuing with this, is a really critical time. And so it's very important not to lose momentum on the advocacy. So there's a whole bunch of things that we're working on related to directly and indirectly to graduate student concerns. One is immigration reform, one is the funding related to sequester, and the other one is to bring more, what's the word I'm looking for, more partners to bear on all of these issues through the industrial community. And be in touch with me, be in touch directly with Steve Johnson, and if you don't mind, just copy me on those. Yeah. And to the extent that you think it's helpful, talk to your counterparts at Weill Cornell, where there's a lot of veteran students as well as professional students. When Mitch comes to Dr. Murphy's student leader meetings, we do have, I forgot what that deal is, that you can see the person. That's
Google Plus.
Google Plus, I knew that.
Yeah. I introduced him to it.
I just wanted to see if you ever heard of him. I know all about it. Skype, that's like behind the times. We should have like FaceTime. wrong technology, but anyway, so see if there's common ground, and also, even though they are very devoted to NIH support, and the NIH support here, of course, is robust, but it's, he puts behind the test support, the same principles obtain in both cases, and talking to each other at 10, this is really, really important. The most important of the three things I told you is number two, though, not to lose confidence in what your future is going to be. Because the placement rate is very, very high in Cornell. It's going to continue to be high. The success rate at grants is high here. It's going to continue to be high because this is a place that has a terrific track record. And so the worst thing that would happen is if people walk away from careers in advanced study, whether it's sciences, social sciences, humanities, because of this particular dysfunctional state of the country's governance right now. We're not going to give up on this. We're working really hard. And some committees that I'm on have re-upped their outreach to the larger higher ed community on these issues. So we had a good night's sleep, had a good cry, and we're back at it again.
Maybe we'll do a spring break lobbying trip by the GPSA.
Yeah. That would be good. You just got to make sure there's somebody there to talk to. It's important to push hard to see the members themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're their constituents. You have a right to talk to your members themselves. And so, if you go into group, it's easier to make that happen. Steve is very good at that.
Okay. So, it's just a little after 6. Do we have time for one more question?
One more.
Okay. Yeah. One more question? Yeah, Liz?
Well, mine is more of a national scope, more of a Cornell scope.
Good.
So, I know there's some uncertainty and concern with the new budget that's being implemented. I was wondering if you could answer that with regard to the impact or potential impact on graduate students, professional and graduate students, but also how that might dovetail in with this push towards MOOC on campus. I know that those seem like two opposite ends of the spectrum.
I think there are logical to put together. MOOCs in the higher education are always brought up in two main contexts, the two main ones. One is the leverage, since many of you already teach, and some of you are going to actually teach for a career, leveraging the effort that it takes a highly qualified professor to prepare a presentation material and present it not just to a class of 100, 500, 1200, but 50,000. And so I think from that point of view, it's very interesting technology. The second one, of course, is more the reason that you might put these together as a potential revenue source for the university. I think it remains to be seen how much of a revenue source that's going to be. Part of the deliverables right now is that you don't have to pay a lot to be a part of it. Most people, the vast majority of people who have taken MOOC courses don't finish them so far. And so, you know, we're in the sort of rough first stages. But I think it's very logical that Cornell get involved in it. And we are getting involved, as you know, the provost and faculty decided to join the consortium. You'll be hearing more about that. And when you have Kent here in April, I'm not sure he's talking more about it. In terms of the budget model, I actually can't give you an intelligence chapter and verse for how it's going to affect all aspects of graduate education. But I think the general answer is it's not going to have a lot of negative effects on graduate education. It will have an effect on the funds flow in units, and that the academic units will be responsible for their own expenditures in a system that is in the direction of so-called responsibility-centered management. But it's a hybrid system where there's also some funds pulled toward the middle for priorities. And I think that my initial reading of it, and I look right away at graduate education, that's my whole background, graduate professional, is that it would not be a negative effect on graduate education. And had you had no interaction with the provost or vice president on that issue yet, is that right?
No, we've reached out to both of them. And
they got some answers about it? Or?
More to get them to come to GPSA, and okay. They can't come to
us. You don't need to be paternalistic about this, but I'll get something a little more specific, and I'll send it to you.
Sure, that'd be great.
And I'll talk to the provost box. I'm seeing them on Wednesday. And Susan, you may have this. You may have a more larger answer than I have.
No, I think it'll be a negative effect on graduate uncertainty and anxiety is because it's a change. And the funds are going to be flowing differently, and I think on this question. Until we really know what it is, that's where the greatest uncertainty is. Once we understand how the revenue is going to come in and how these funds are going out, and in the case of graduate education, how you align TI money coming into the center and putting it out in the department. Until I've actually seen people have, myself included, because I have other budgets, I can tell you all the worst case scenario, because that's sort of what I'm trying to look at, so I don't really know until it actually flows. So I think you're living with us right now in the period of greater uncertainty. And a year from now, we'll figure out what works in the model, what were some of the areas that are capable of grades that really needed to be tweaked, and we'll discover that the university didn't come to a screeching halt. And we stopped graduate education just because the funds are flowing differently. But because there are a lot of there's a lot of the devils in the details, and the details are just we're getting to it as we're getting ready to get. In 10 days, I'm going to get my budget sheet for the Division of Student and Academic Services, and I might have a huge sigh of relief for what I'm worried about. I might have a panic attack. Or I might go, okay, this is about what we projected, and now we have to figure out how to, count things differently. So you're good, you raised the question. I would, when the provost comes back, and says he and Myra Mangum are the ones who know it the best, Plus, by that point, the budget will have been allocated out to the units. It would be a very focused question to, what was their intent, and then what do they think is really going to be happening?
It's important to say, though, I'm sorry for interrupting you, apologize. It's important to say, though, and I'm going to say this forcefully, that graduate education is included as a high value in the institution planning the budget model. This is like, we're going to go figure out how to do it, and then we'll see, oh yeah, it's graduate education. It was up there, high on thinking about developing the model. But I'll also write it, and we'll also be here. I'm sorry, you were going to say something.
I was just going to say, I'm glad we're all on the same boat as far as knowing what's going to come with this. And I also hope that you keep graduate students in the loop when it comes to both when the detailed shakedown in the budget model, but also when the detailed sort of shakedown in MOOC, because as you just identified, as the next generation of teachers, we have a lot to look forward to.
Yeah, definitely. Well, one more quick thing. One of the intents of the new budget model, which you almost wish somehow there was a way to extrapolate this kind of thing into the country as a whole, in a thoughtful way, is to put the place on a better footing for sustainable moving forward. And the last step, just to make sure that you don't see this as an isolated, just crazy idea somebody had, it's the last step in a systematic process that started in 08-09 with the recession, realized that we were in a serious deficit situation on campus. And some of you weren't here at the time. But that year, we had an in-year deficit in the consolidated operating budget of $150 million, projecting that to be $200 million by 2015 if we were worried about it. And the budget of the campus is $2 billion. And of that $2 billion, about $700 million is restricted money. Grants and gifts. And so it was 11 or 12% of the discretionary budget in deficit. Now the budget is balanced. And the second problem was that the university became very heavy leverage on debt to do construction projects, quadrupled the debt in a decade, to the point where the debt was nearly $2 billion, including the debt service to pay back those funds. Now we've stopped borrowing money, the budget is balanced, and now the provost has developed a new budget model that's designed to have people responsible in understanding that decisions they make about expenditures will have a reflection on what's available to prevent us from getting back into deficit. And so, thanks for letting me go on and on about that, because it's really important to understand the context in which it was done. And I'm very supportive of it because the best thing that we can do for you and for students that follow is to make sure that the place has sufficient liquidity to do what it has to do to continue to hire faculty, pay grad students, and do our share of the cost share of that research. So I'm very high on the idea. But it is true that until all of us, including the president's office, get our budgets, we don't know exactly what it's going to look like. You can be sure, though, that the office budgets for administrative offices, I think Susan will agree with me, was held at less of a high value than the sort of stuff that we have. That's the case in the beginning of the session. Okay, we're going to go now.
Yeah, thank you. And if there are any other questions, send them my way, and we'll pass along to both of you, and then you can respond. Yeah, great. Thank you so much.
The best part was the one comment on my head.
Thanks. All right, so I'm gonna move us forward. We had a good discussion. So, Rob, if you can finish quickly, that would be great.
For the break, I showed you a bunch of data, and this chart is going to do kind of two possible paths. One in red, which is where CO2 emissions kind of go from linearly up to plateauing out, which is what ExxonMobil thinks we'll be doing by 2030. And you can see that plateauing out will actually lead to temperature increases because we'll still be emitting the same amount every year. So we actually need to bring it down. Okay, so the next two slides are really to show you that when the world changes what fuels it uses, it doesn't do so because we run out of fuel. It does so due to economic reasons. So here you can see from 1800, we're going to be going back, we can't see the numbers, all the way to 2040, what we burn slash how we get energy. And you can see that we used to burn a lot of wood, that's all the dark brown, and we used to burn a lot of coal. And we don't do that so much anymore, but we actually still have plenty of wood and coal. And the reason why we moved on to new fuels is because they have a higher return on investment. So if you calculate out the energy density from that, and if you calculate out the cost of extraction, it makes more sense to use oil and gas than wood and coal. So that's why we're using it, not because we're running out of fossil fuels. And this shows you in the last 3 decades, we keep using more and more oil, but the area of this chart shows you the amount of proven oil reserves is actually increasing more and more because it's more economically viable to access the harder to reach oil. So there was actually a big boom in 2012 with this black circle because now horizontal drilling and hydrofracking are economically viable to get new natural gas reserves. So these are a couple of takeaway points. Just one of the things that I want to mention before we look at the resolution is that this is a little bit different than what we usually discuss here, but these issues really do affect graduate students. You guys will have to deal with the effects of climate change later in your life and so will your children. Cornell is doing a lot of work on sustainability, which is really good. It's reducing greenhouse gas emissions on campus. It's on track to stop emitting greenhouse gases by 2050. But I just want to remind you of the last few slides. And if we stop emitting greenhouse gases, that's not necessarily the most efficient way to get the world back on track to lowering that CO2 output. The financial means are really the best way to do it. And also, when we go to the resolution, please note that the resolve clauses that Mitch and I have prepared, I think, really take into account the difficulties of reinvesting billions and tens of millions of dollars, which is kind of the scope of what is currently the university currently invests in fossil fuel companies. And so the timeline is much more drawn out than what some other people have suggested. And more flexible to allow the university to kind of figure out the best way to do.
Great, thanks Rob. And I'm going to quickly bring up the resolution. And it is similar in a way to the undergraduate resolution that was passed a couple weeks back, but it differs because our timeline that we've indicated is 2050 and not 2020, and it pegs it to the Climate Action Plan. Sorry, that can't read it in the back. And so this is the bulk of the resolve clauses. So I'll stop and we'll open it up for discussion. Evan? Yeah. Thank you. So the undergraduate resolution that calls for divestment called for total divestment, I think, by 2020. And in Rob and I's discussion, we thought that was a little too unrealistic. And as he mentioned, as he was walking back to his seat, we meant this resolution to be very much understanding of the realities that go into investing $5.5 billion as part of an institutional endowment. So this gives a clear message to the trustees, but also allows flexibility for them to do whatever they do in their investment processes. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Evan, you were first.
I have three questions. First is, what percentage or dollar figure of the endowment is currently invested in fossil fuels?
So I'm going to try to answer that. Derek, if I get it wrong, please tell me, since you hopefully know this better than I do. So there's a large portion of the endowment that's invested in an indexed fund, which is essentially indexed to all sectors of the economy, and somewhere in the order of 14% of that indexed fund is in the energy sector and mostly in the fossil fuel sector. So somewhere in the order of 10 to 14% of the indexed fund, which is a large percentage of the actual endowment. Derek, did I get any of that right?
Yeah, no, it's on the summary order. 12%
of the endowment is in the index.
So the index fund is
Yeah, so those socially responsible investing is essentially a strategy of investment, and part of that can include negative screening of your investments. So you filter out the negatives, so you filter out the tobacco companies, you filter out the gun companies, you filter out whatever you put in the screen, and so that might be one way to attack this issue of fossil fuels. And the alternate way is to positively screen companies. So you're investing, you're using a tool to invest in the good instead of filtering out the bad. So that's what this means. It's a little technical, but those who read it will.
Yeah. The people who it's intended for, the board of investment committee, the CFO, et cetera, fund their own.
Yeah. I'm a city planner, so.
on the other one, though, first of all, do you want to say we support the sentiment, or, we support the intent, but I mean, we don't support the word-for-word content of the resolution that they passed? I mean, 30 years, but.
Yeah. All right, David. Okay, Trevani, yeah.
Well, just back to the positive screen, I'm still unclear then how we determine what is good or bad, right? Your perception is good and my perception is good are really different. And what GPSA thinks is probably just what Forrest Christian thinks. So if there's a way to make that more clear, I don't know, or there's some way that GPSA can say, what do you mean socially responsible, and what do you mean positive, these are the areas we should be able to look at.
Okay. David?
I have two questions. One related to the investment side of it. You're asking them to not invest in a particular sector. Do you guys have in mind other sectors that would give a similar return on investment? Or is it just, like you said, oil, you get a good return? But I don't know if you can make comment on this or how willing it would be to move that money somewhere where they're actually not going to make as much money back on their investment.
Yeah.
I think we do think that I don't want to specifically take this on the resolution, but we had a conversation with the Board of Trustees about this on a meeting in New York City back at the end of January, beginning of February. And there's two things that I can report for sure that the investment committee would say about this. I'm not a member of the investment committee. They would say
One, that their number one job as, you know, fiduciary to the university is to make sure that we're meeting our goals for a positive outlook on the endowment, meaning the financial returns. The financial returns, in accordance with our goals. And I know that the investment committee feels very strongly with the firm members on it, that they would not take any action that would lead to a reduction in what their core thing is for the return on the investment. Doesn't mean that they wouldn't, you know, invest in something different, but not just anything they think is going to adversely affect the return. The current investment committee also believes that in the coming decade, which is less relevant to this resolution than to the essay resolution, in the next coming decade, that there are certain fossil fuel investments who say that they're favorable. And I guess the one other thing I would say about
Thanks. Adrian, you're next.
Yeah, it's different from you today on about the criteria for me. I didn't know that something was interesting, but I know there are examples, so just like the index on the track, like the data on the I think there used to be a company called Domina that had its own index of social responsible companies and that had a methodology and responsibility or something like that. Not necessarily specifically.
Sure.
Trying to say that I think you did a good job with this talk. Reading the FA resolution would be the FA resolution would be something that I would not have supported at all because I think it got into very specifics that weren't really thought out for your question. I think this is a step in the right direction, but I get the feeling that it's saying a lot of very specific things that we don't have the expertise to really understand. So socially responsible investments, like mechanics of divesting a $5 billion endowment fund. So I think it would be better if we consider a resolution that was more of a, you know, how wants to be carbon neutral. If we still hold investments, that's a conflict and, you know, something that we shouldn't hold. So it'd be good if we're made steps to become to divest from fossil fuels. But as far as the timeline, you know, this is good because it's a specified timeline. But as far as, you know, 30%, it seems like arbitrary numbers, which did it come from anything other than, I know that the AIM resolution at 30% as well, but I just think
it was mainly that.
I just think a more broader sense of the resolution.
So the essay asked to reinvest 30% of the money divested by 2020 into, I think, renewable energy investments by 2030. And we were just like, well, let's hold on, like, let's just create like a small habit the companies that we invest in. So this says that, okay, if we want to do this divestment thing, a small amount of the money that we divest, just a small amount of the endowment, we should screen when we invest in the market. So we just get in the habit of looking at what we're actually putting money in. And that was important as well.
I'm going to take Bill, and then we'll think about the rest of our timeline for the meeting. Yeah, Bill.
I wish we had more information from the trustee investment committee. I mean, I haven't spread this resolution past maybe asking for the feasibility of the investment committee in doing this before we go passing the resolution. And aside from that, I have a lot of little nitpicky things about the resolution itself. Talking about, you know, not supporting companies that produce, refine, and distribute, combust, or sell fossil fuels. I mean, every industry uses combustion. Fossil fuels pretty much nowadays. So, I mean, that's a pretty broad statement as it is. And then this whole, I don't really agree with you guys when you say that it's pretty well defined with socially responsible investment. I mean, look at New York City going against Coca-Cola and soft drinks. Are you going to say in 10 years now that candy companies and Hostess, they host that example, but, junk food is going to be a bad investment to do, and I think that should be a different piece. This whole social investment responsibility aspect should be a different kind of resolution, and this should be focused mainly on fossil fuels and feasibility. You know, So I don't really support this, and I think it would be better for us. I support the idea, and I've read this other resolution saying we'd like to get the thoughts of the trustee finance by investment committee to figure out if this is feasible, what's not feasible, you know, how important this is in being diversified endowment and to protection financial security of institutions. That's my opinion.
Thanks, Bill. So we have I'm gonna jump in right here. So we have 30 minutes left until 7 o'clock, and we have more than 30 minutes of things to get through. So I would entertain a motion to either vote or to table the resolution until next time. I think those would be appropriate at this point. Trevaney? Okay. Is there a second? Okay. Evan, is there anything wrong with the process that we're going through? Is this?
There needs to be a vote. You could just say, is there any objection?
Okay. Okay. Is there any objection to tabling the motion? Great. Seeing none, we'll table it and bring it back up on March 25th.
Okay. I'm going to suggest that if this does turn into some sort of request for information from the investment committee or some sort of response at all, from the Board of Trustees, that if people are interested in working with Rob Mitch, maybe do that so that hopefully, if you're ready, something could come out at that March 25th meeting, because we'll meet 2 days later.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it would be something that it would be after all the time that I bring up and mention to the board.
Sure. Yeah, Rob and I will try to do that. And if anyone else is interested, let me know or has additional thoughts on the resolution, be sure to send them our way. All right, so thank you for that. We'll go ahead and move into the GCI topic area breakout sessions. So first of all, I'm going to ask all of the people introducing these different topic areas to keep it short and sweet, starting with myself in transportation. So these are our two objectives that we put together for transportation. One essentially deals with parking, and the other deals with public transportation. So the parking is very much directed at Cornell and sort of internal to campus, and the public transportation is kind of a murky area where we're recommending things recommending agencies or entities outside of Cornell do things. So as we think about and have these discussions today, think about that. If you think it's not right for us to be doing that, or you think there's a better way to ask for it or suggest it, let me know. And the sources, we have some information from the registrar and the transportation services, as well as breakout sessions and then the previous GCI. So, diversity international students, I think you have Jenny and Mona. Yeah.
Well, I'll try to be quick with a few slides, but I think what I want to say is that this has become a really big topic because people are really interested in talking about diversity and international issues affecting diversity and international students. And so I listed some of the members. We have two new members today, and Brandon just joined last week, so there was really a lot of enthusiasm to discuss these issues. And we're really covering a lot of broad sections, so issues affecting students of color, international students, gender equality, and the LGBTQ community. And so we've had a couple of opportunities to collect data. We had time to discuss last week that focused on diversity a little bit. We attended the BGDSA unit, so the Black Graduate Professional Student Association. We've met with Dean of Diversity. We're going to meet with Aisha Stone at a town hall on diversity this coming Wednesday that I'll make an announcement in my student advocacy update. There's going to be more opportunities to collect information. And if you go to the next slide, and I think that really outlines our the first objective that we really think covers all issues. And one is to increase diversity and representation within the GCSA. There's so much discussion on these issues happening, but really motivated and excited graduate students. There's groups involved, there's people involved, and I think one thing that's lacking is really a strong connection to the GCSA. That's not a bad thing. I think it's a reflection of that groups are becoming stronger and more interested, and I think it's a really amazing opportunity to get the GCSA involved and really make connections. So we really, and this is up for debate of how to, the best way to do this, but what we recommend is establishing a standing committee to discuss this issue on an ongoing basis. And then we can ask this committee to basically report back to the GCSA, consider giving voting rights, is one of the things that we constantly get back. And the feedback is that voting membership, whatever that means to this committee, encourages participation, broad participation, and that there should be an annual meeting for groups representing diversity and international students. Again, honestly, personal contact, meeting these students and forming relationships, I think one of the most important things we can do. So we did come up with some practical objectives in international students. Two things that really stood out for us was support the career services for international students, and two, support the unique mental health needs in the African population. There's some other things that we'd be happy to discuss in the breakout session. For diversity issue, we focused on the four student of color groups that are present at Cornell, so the Black Graduate Student Association, the Indigenous Graduate Student Association, Latino Graduate Student Association, and the Society for Asian American Graduate Student Affairs, and we came up with these five things that seem to be important across the board. So establish diversity office, an officer in every college to support these communities, continue supporting centers for students of diverse backgrounds, and address the cultural social adjustments faced by diversity students, respond to bias, support the graduate student perspective, and then increase support for first-generation students. And if you go to the next slide, most recently, so Trevanian has joined us in incorporating Resolution 10 into the document. We want to have two introductory sections on gender issues and issues affecting the LGBT community. Currently, there's nothing specific in the GCI addressing this community. And I don't think we have time to be as extensive in our research and kind of understanding of what the communities are, but I think adding these two sections and introductions will give grounds for future work. This GCI is a guide for future GPSA activity, and I think it will have a great impact on that.
Great, thanks. And now moving on to sense of community.
So sense of community, this is kind of, in a way, the most all-encompassing of the topic areas, given it's the Graduate Community Initiative. Most of the sources for this were from the town hall we had earlier this year, as well as the Diamond Discuss, and the earlier 2007 GCI was really helpful. I think the biggest thing that I heard in these conversations was the importance of sort of meaningful, forming meaningful relationships with other people and other students, and sort of what that would mean to sort of create a deep sense of connectedness and community among the grad student population. And so most of the recommendations are sort of surrounding that. So one is to improve these opportunities for meaningful interactions and interdisciplinary collaborations, and make some specific suggestions about ways that could happen. The second thing is to continue supporting programming and events that are mostly social programming, basically. Support and encourage student development and personal growth. This is sort of a climate thing, but having advisors and faculty be supportive of students' have interests and activities outside of the lab and their research if they choose to do so. And then finally, improving integration and communication across academic and administrative units, and recruiting graduate students into that process, I think, is a really neat opportunity. So, things like advertising seminars and across this one. And I mentioned that, so that's it.
Great, thanks. So I'm going to amend the slide a little bit and say we all have 7 minutes for our discussion. So given I know that we are running a little bit behind on time, and I'd appreciate it if everyone would stick around, and then we'll zip through the committee reports when we're done. So why don't we do like we did last time? We'll have one group over here, one group up in the audience area, if you will, and the other group over here. And then every 7 minutes, we'll just rotate the facilitators, if you will. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not really concerned about sending them. I mean, just send them easily. Okay, I'm gonna have us go ahead and get started. Sorry that we ran so long. This is one of the few times I'm just gonna blame President Swarton for talking longer. It was great, fantastic.
Being late
but
and
yeah,
talking.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, so I just want to get through a couple of these. I know that our attendance is down quite substantially as of now, which is fine. And I'm going to see if we can just go ahead and send these reports out to the membership too, because it's worth it to the committee chairs to get their message out. So I'm going to skip mine. I'm going to go ahead and skip our executive committee report. Move straight to Bill. Do you have anything?
No.
Okay. Fantastic. Marcus didn't either.
No.
Vinay?
No.
All right. This might go quicker than I thought. Giovanna?
On Friday at the GCIS, and
thanks to all of you who went to Grad Night on Friday. It was really packed and really good.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks. Evgeny?
Yeah, so we had our giant discuss last week on the community. I think it was a huge success. We filled a big red barn. Here on the left, you'll picture the dean of the graduate students. A student, Barbara Lynch, was here. But there, students like President Murphy came by. There were new students from all over. A lot of student leaders, a lot of students signed up. On the right, we got a keynote speech by Dan LeMay. That was really great. And then, if you go to the next slide, I want to thank the student and community. Did a great job putting this together. We had an awesome lead on the project and MC David Bunk on the right. He also does weddings, and that's true. he did an awesome job MCing, but I think it was a great event. And so now we're going to follow up on the note. And just want to let you know that there's a graduate student town hall on diversity issues this coming Wednesday, 4:30 p.m. at the Intercultural Center, 66 Thurston Ave. I'll send an email with this attachment. And you can distribute this field and come by if you're interested in investing.
Great, thanks, Vivian. Fantastic. And I know Parag had to leave early, but we are getting the word out about the faculty awards for teaching, advising, and mentoring. And the nominations will begin on the 8th, which I think is Friday. Not quite sure. March 8th. And then we'll close those nominations in a month from Friday. And then there's a committee of people that are going to review those and make the final decisions. Then we'll have our award ceremony on May 7th. I went last year. It's a really great ceremony. The Faculty Awards Committee did a good job last year, and it really means a lot to the faculty members. So I'd encourage you guys all to distribute this information nominate your faculty members. And with that, is there anyone for Open Forum?
I have one thing.
Yes.
Since you're also here, it's clear that you've got a face. So we're looking for a couple of grad students to serve on the Student Services Advisory Board. If Susan Murphy was still here, she could have pitched it a little bit better. But it's about the registrar, the bursar, and financial aid, those sorts of administrative offices, and how they can better serve the students, and how they can possibly be more streamlined. They're looking into consolidating websites and possibly offices on campus. So it would only be, I think, 1 or 2 hour-long meetings in the semester, so it's really not that big of a time issue. So if you're interested in something like that and helping out and serving on that committee, let me know. Yes.
Sir, I have one more.
Yes, please.
I just really wanted to follow up with the president. This weekend, I had the opportunity to go to PG for the National Association of Graduate Professional Students to do a lot of advocacy work, a lot of great work in Washington. But you're getting questions that the Western Funding and the discussion that the Open Access Health Facilities Community, well, two of the main issue areas that we need to get dealing with. And I know the impact of energy and ideas that have been fueled on our campus as well as doing that. So, hopefully, you'll be able to take more.
Absolutely. Yeah, and thanks for going down. Yeah, thanks, Adrian. Anyone else for Open Forum? Great. Seeing no more, the meeting is adjourned. Have a good spring break.
Oh, yeah.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.